If you have a child with a severe food allergy, you worry when you're not with them. Whether your child is going to a sleepover or summer camp, you know how critical it is to be prepared for an allergic emergency. AviQ is the first and only voice-guided epinephrine auto-injector that tells you or a caregiver how to use it. So even when your guidance isn't available, AviQ's guidance can be. It's the voice mamas everywhere can trust as much as their own. Learn more at avi-q.com/motherly. That's avi-q.com/motherly. After using AviQ epinephrine injection, USP, seek emergency medical care. Visit aviq.com for full prescribing and patient information. The women in my family have, frankly, gone through menopause at a wide range of times, some in their early 40s and others mid 50s, even pushing 60. So when I think about what that journey is going to look like for me, I really have a lot of question marks. I don't know which side of my family I'm going to follow, but I am glad that I am on the precipice of that season of life at a time when our culture is starting to talk so much more openly about the realities of being a woman. And we've had taboos being broken around things like getting your first period and not being embarrassed and normalizing the pregnancy and postpartum experience and bringing that to the forefront in our culture. And now we are finally at a place where talking about what it's like to endure, anticipate, thrive through menopause is more and more a mainstream part of our culture, whether we're talking about investment in solutions, a richer understanding of the medical possibilities, just empathy for women going through menopause and the way that that reshapes your life personally, sexually, even at work. This is an area that is really ripe for cultural conversation, and it's time we bring it to the fore. Hey mama, welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy. I am a co-founder here at Motherly, and I'm also a mother of five myself. Today's guest is Dr. Somi Javed. Dr. Javed is an OBGYN, a sexual medicine expert, and menopause advocate. In 2015, she founded HerMD, which is a team of doctors with the mission of improving women's healthcare by educating, advocating for, and empowering patients to take control of their health. In our conversation, we talk all things women's health, and specifically, we talk all things menopause. Dr. Javed shares what women really need to know about perimenopause and menopause, and why it has taken so long to normalize these conversations in medicine as well as the broader culture. Dr. Somi Javed, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you are an OBGYN, but I am curious, once you actually became a mother yourself, what surprised you about motherhood?
Oh God, I remember distinctly having this conversation with my mother because I thought I would be so good at staying up all night, right, with the baby. And so, because you're used to taking call all night, I worked 48 hours straight, delivering babies, doing surgery, seeing patients. But at some point, the pager, because back then it wasn't cell phones, right, stops going off. And so I remember calling my mom one cranky morning when the baby had kept me up all night. And she's like, I'm surprised you're struggling with this. I thought you would have done really well with this transition. I was like, Mom, pagers stop. Babies don't. And I think that was my first real teaching moment that you don't learn in medical school about babies, right? You know about anatomy, you know about nutrition, you know about weight gain, weight loss, jaundice, all of that stuff. But they don't teach you how to survive the nights with a smile on your face.
I do find that really interesting because I can't think of much else that's as challenging as what I understand the career path of a doctor to be, certainly in OBGYN. Babies come when they come, right? And they like to come in the middle of the night. So you're used to this 24/7 schedule, years and years of intellectual challenge. Why do you think you weren't prepared for that part of motherhood, despite being through a lot of hard stuff and adjacent to the motherhood experience as an OBGYN?
I think for two reasons. They don't teach you about it in medical school or residency. And I think the second part of it is it's honestly, I think, one of the hardest things that you do. I mean, sleep deprivation has so many negative effects upon a human being. And so I had continual sleep deprivation from work. I was on call every third night. And when I came home, the only thing I wanted to do was spend time with my baby. And if I didn't stay awake with my baby, then I didn't get to spend time with him. And so it was just a perpetual, I would almost say, a fog of trying to survive, because I was really in the thick of it. And I think those two reasons, when you take the emotional component, the lack of education, I was young. I was 25 when I decided to have my first. And so I think the combination of those factors was the perfect storm. And so despite my pediatrician's advice, my son was in my bed until he was 3.5 years old, because it's how we survived.
Love that topic. We'll circle back on that one. But I also am curious about how experiencing motherhood you think may have shaped your medical career. At 25, I don't hear of many doctors who have babies at 25. I was 27, definitely felt unusual where I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. How did that just real lived experience of motherhood shape your approach as a doctor?
It matures you really, really quickly, obviously. And in medicine, you always put the needs of your patients before your own, right? You're going to deal with an emergency before you're going to deal with your own hunger. You're going to take care of a patient before you're going to go to the bathroom. And I think motherhood just teaches you that, right? It definitely made me a much more patient human being, for sure. And it really teaches you on what's important in life and to not stress the little things. And so it really helped me lead other physicians on my team, because I had that world experience that maybe they didn't have yet, because I was one of the few mothers in the program. And so you're right, I was a young mother, but I had a condition called polycystic ovary syndrome. So I knew that I may face infertility, and I did not want to delay that journey until I was done with all of my medical training, because it's 4 years of pre-med, 4 years of medical school, and 4 years of residency. So I tried to find this bucket of time. I had him right at the end of medical school, 6 weeks before graduation, right before residency, right? And people would think that you're crazy, but I didn't know how long it was going to take me to get pregnant. And because I was lucky and got that diagnosis very early. So for me, it empowered me to make decisions about my childbearing.
Again, another whole rabbit hole I could go down, but there's so much I want to talk to you about. So your oldest is a boy. You have this expertise in women's health. I'm curious how you talk about your work and what it means to support and empower women and mothers over those milestones of talking about gender difference, talking about puberty. How do you share the importance of wellness, both for men and women, but in particular for what you do?
I approach it much like I do with my patients. I used to spend a lot of time speaking to young teenagers, because I would see them as young as 12 as patients for acne, for abnormal bleeding, for endometriosis. So I got very used to talking to children about their bodies, about their anatomy, about taking away shame or stigma or taboo, and telling people, we can't help you unless you tell us what's going on. And for example, your vagina is a body part, right? It's not dirty. It's no different than talking to your doctor about a headache or an earache. And so really empowered my children to tell me what's going on. I would tell them things like, if you're curious about sex or sexuality or what you're hearing at school, your mom's a little bit of an expert. And I said, I want you to get the correct information. And so really approach them from a safe harbor kind of approach, and telling them that they could ask me anything, and I would always be as honest as I could with them. Now, obviously, my answers were always age appropriate. My daughter came home one day and she was in preschool. And I remember she told me, she's like, I got in trouble today. And I was like, why? And she's like, well, my teacher said that her baby was in her stomach. And I said, no, it's not. It's in your uterus. And I was like, you got in trouble for that? That's the right anatomy. But my kids are very, very open about their relationships, about sexual questions. And my husband will joke that you will hear vagina, the word, around our dining table, like you talk about a concert. And he is totally a girl dad. God love him. I came home one time and his pocket was filled with pads and tampons. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, they both got their period while you were gone. And at that point, my daughter wasn't driving yet. So he's like, and they're not prepared. And so he's got it in his back pocket. I'm like, I just love you so much more.
That is amazing. I love that.
So a little bit of humor, a little bit of humility. Sometimes as a mom, I wanted to go in the other room and scream and be like, oh my God, no, not yet. Not this early, because I'm still their mother. But in front of them, always immense calm, empowerment, education. And I really want all of them to have this sense of body autonomy. It's your body. It's your decision. I feel like sometimes sex ed comes from this fear mongering, like if you have sex, you will get an STD or you will get pregnant. And that's not the way I taught my children.
You talked about how open you have been with your children around these topics. I'm curious what your own upbringing was like around sexuality and talking about it, because for me in our home, it was taboo. I'm the oldest. My parents loosened up a bit for the other kids, but for me, I felt completely unable to discuss it, even unable to talk about my periods until pretty late. So how was how you're raising your kids, how you talked about that, different from how you grew up? And how did you personally navigate any feelings of unease that you might have had because of that?
Stark opposite. I grew up in a strict Southeast Asian household. My parents are Pakistani. Sex is not a topic to be discussed. Forbidden until marriage, right? Both religiously and culturally. So as far as menstruation, our mother actually, really proud of her, did teach us about that, did talk to us about pads, menstrual cramps. I had a lot of problems because of my polycystic ovarian. I mean, she took me to the gynecologist at 13. So my mom was very forward-thinking, given how she was raised, and very empowered that way. But going back to the sexuality, my parents know what I do now. And at first, when I started her MD, my parents would be like, she's a gynecologist. They would never talk about sexual health expert or even the menopause portion. But my mother happened to be in an event 2 months ago where I was speaking with Stacey London about menopause, sexuality, particularly in the breast cancer space and survivorship. And someone asked my mother a question because they knew she was in the audience and she was the impetus for me starting her MD. And they said, how do you feel about what your daughters do? Kamel is my sister and co-founder. And I was like, oh my God, she's going to fake not knowing English. Like, I know it, because my mother is also shy. And she literally, my mom is 70 plus, spoke up in a room full of women. I mean, there were over 200 women. And she was like, I am so proud of what they're doing for women and bringing these issues to the forefront. You know, I asked my mom that day later, I go, how in the world did that happen, Mom? And she said, so me, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was in a community of women where it was okay to talk about such things. And I was like, that is what education and empowerment and advocacy does, that even a woman in her seventh decade of life had that aha moment that I'm allowed to talk about this and it's okay. So that has come full circle from forbidden and taboo to my mother being proud of the work that we do.
Oh, I love that. What a great story. So yes, tell us the origin story of her MD.
I'm 48 now. I just had a birthday. But when my mother was 45 years old, she nearly died of cardiovascular disease. She presented with left arm pain, shortness of breath, chest pain, and science and data at the time couldn't explain why a thin, non-smoking woman would ever present with four-vessel disease. And they continually dismissed her. They told her, oh, your kids are stressing you out. You need to cut back on your caffeine. I'm pre-med at Northwestern looking at this EKG going, this is abnormal. And they're like, oh, women's EKGs, they can be abnormal. She ended up getting rushed into emergent quadruple bypass surgery. And yeah, she had over a 95% occlusion of the widowmaker. So if the heart attack would have come, my mom would not have survived. And it was preventable. Luckily, she's alive to this day. people are like, well, surely you were uninsured. No, we had insurance. Surely you were somewhere very remote. No, we were in Cleveland, the mecca of cardiovascular care. It's because she was a minority woman. And up until very recently, actually still, women are underrepresented in clinical research trials. We are faced with provider bias. There are not enough women decision makers. There's not enough research funding and data for women. And so because of that, we are more likely to die of our cardiovascular disease. We wait longer in ERs for our pain medications compared to our male counterparts. And there are some diseases that take up to 10 years to diagnose in this country. And so I watched my mother almost die. And like I said, I was pre-med. That was my aha moment that I was going to be an advocate for women. Fast forward through medical school residency, all those years I talked about, got my first real job. And the realities of our very, very broken healthcare system smacked me in my very idealistic face. I was seeing 50 patients a day.
Yeah, the math doesn't work. The math ain't mathing on that one. No.
No, I didn't have time to go to the bathroom. I didn't have time to eat. I, at the end of the day, could not remember who my first patient was. I was practicing doorknob medicine, where your hand is on the door because they're still talking to you, but the nurses are knocking saying, you have eight on deck. Eight on deck means they've already filled eight more rooms for you. And so when the timing was right, personally, when my kids were old enough, I came home one day and I told my husband, I said, I'm either going to stay home and raise these beautiful babies that we went through infertility for, or I'm going to start something, but it's got to be on my terms and what patients deserve. And he cracks me up. He was like, baby, I love you, but you will drive us all bananas if you stay home. And so I support you and you need to do this. So I tried to pitch this business plan to multiple hospital systems and they told me it would never work. My father was like, if you don't find an open door, build your own damn door. And that was the first HER-MD in 2015 in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Women are not just half of the population. We actually are 51% of the population. And yet, as you described, our medical needs are so frequently dismissed. We have a very unique health journey, especially listeners who have become mothers and either are planning a pregnancy, pregnant, postpartum in some capacity. So why is it that we got to a place where something as basic as providing care centered on the needs of more than half of the population wasn't seen as fundable, wasn't seen as viable? Can you just describe how we got to this place of, again, half the population, more than half? We're almost like the sideshow somehow in medicine rather than the normative.
So underrepresentation in clinical research trials is still going on. Not enough funding. So less than 2% of funding dollars go to female founders like myself. There's more female physicians, which is amazing because a lot of patients have better outcomes when they have a female provider because we tend to listen. But even though we outnumber men in the clinical workforce, we don't outnumber them in those boardrooms and those decision-making rooms. And then we talked about the time component. That is a huge barrier to care, both for the patient. How do you get your story in, build rapport, tell your doctor everything, and then get all your questions answered? But also for the provider, how am I supposed to meet you, gain your trust, find out what's going on, make a diagnosis, explain to you your options, don't forget to type it all up into the chart, and then send your prescriptions in 15 minutes. And so our insurance systems, these 15-minute appointments have absolutely murdered us. Stigma, taboo, and shame. Dismissals that these are not things that are appropriate to talk about. Historically, when providers were mostly male, there was a study done that women were looked at for two outcomes, baby making. So that's why there have been advances in reproductive care, but also objects of male pleasure. And so that's why when you look at female sexual health, for example, there are 26 medications for men and two FDA approved options for women. I mean, the Latin root for uterus is mitra. But when we remove a uterus, it's hysterectomy. Why? Because we're going to remove the hysteria from a woman. And so those are just some of the barriers that have existed in how we have gotten here with women's healthcare, and then a complete lack of education. If you talk to women, you ask them what's missing, they don't know their anatomy. they don't understand what menopause is. No one talks to them about menstruation, or we tend to normalize women's pain or heavy bleeding. And everyone read the New York Times article that came out that menopause has the worst PR campaign ever. We did this horrible study that was stopped early, and basically women threw out their hormone therapy. We had this huge press conference, but then no one talked about all the studies later that came out that proved the benefits of hormone therapy, or even the original data points from that original study that were positive. And so it got the worst PR campaign ever. Providers stopped learning about menopause. And in this country, currently, we talk about the lack of education. Why? No safe spaces for women. Women say, well, if I look on a website, everyone's trying to sell me something, right? But also for providers, less than 20% of us nationally are trained in menopause and sexual health care. And you touched upon this, 51% of the world's population. But do you know, with increasing life expectancy, you and I are going to spend 40% of our life in menopause. And 93% of medical residents say they're not prepared to take care of this population. And less than 20% of OBGYNs are trained in this area. So this, my friend, is how we've gotten here.
When your child has severe food allergies, you know you can't protect them every moment of their life. And the last thing you want is for them to miss out on life. So you stress allergen avoidance. You make sure everyone knows the action plan. And as they go and grow, you hope your child carries your voice in their head. But just in case, make sure they carry AviQ's voice with them too. AviQ is the first and only voice-guided epinephrine auto-injector. Learn more at avi-q.com/motherly. That's AUVI-Q.com/motherly. After using AviQ Epinephrine Injection USP, seek emergency medical care. Visit AviQ.com/motherly for full prescribing and patient information. One of the cool and challenging things about being a woman is we don't have this linear experience in our bodies. We have these seasons and cycles, and they're a little bit different for everyone. Can you talk about what it takes to feel supported medically and also socially and mentally as a woman through these various seasons, and what not just you're doing, but what our listeners can do to get the support that they need?
Yeah. So I think knowledge and education is key, and community. Women don't want to feel alone as they're going through phases. And so a lot of women don't understand the difference between perimenopause and menopause, and don't understand that it can start very young. So just some really basics. The average age of menopause in the United States is 51. What does menopause mean? 12 consecutive months without any bleeding, menstruation, or if a woman has had a partial hysterectomy or had an ablation or has an IUD in place, there's hormone testing we can do. We check something called an FSH, and it increases as estrogen and testosterone are decreasing, because it's trying to wake up the ovary saying, hey, what's going on? So there are two different ways to make that diagnosis. So once again, in this country, average age is 51. That being said, perimenopause is the years leading up to menopause. And for some women, it can start as early as 10 years prior to menopause. And so if the women in your family go through menopause at like 45, 46, you are looking at perimenopause starting in your 30s. And people are like, well, how is perimenopause different than menopause? Identical. So you can have all of the same symptoms: brain fog, hot flashes, insomnia, decreased libido, painful sex, vaginal dryness, joint pain, weight gain. The only difference is in the perimenopausal state, you are still having bleeding. It may not be your regular cycle, like monthly, but you are having some type of bleeding. But women often do not know how severe the perimenopause can be.
What are some of the typical first signs of perimenopause, and what should we be doing to better understand, again, as this generation breaking down the stigma, what's going to happen? So I'm thinking about things like we should maybe talk to our sisters and aunts and moms about when they went through menopause, those kinds of things. And then what should we be looking out for?
So definitely talking to our family, because that's one of the most predictive things, is when the women in your family went through menopause. That will help you understand when you will. But we talked about community and removing the stigma, taboo, and shame. It's going to be all of our collective voices, right? Providers, but also friends, sisters, mothers. If we talk to each other and teach each other and we're honest about our own journeys, then I think women won't feel so unprepared. That's where a lot of the fear comes in. You know, Stacey London has shared her story. Oprah thought she had cardiovascular disease. And if you want to talk about someone with access and the best doctors, right? She went to a multitude of doctors. Tamsin Fadal, who is an Emmy Award-winning news anchor and who is a face of menopause. Her and I have had many discussions. And she had no idea what was happening with her first hot flash. And that's where I say knowledge is power. And so there are a lot of great websites now. Women S is a company that sells menopause products, but they have a great community discussion board for patients. Stripes, Naomi Watts's company, same thing. They are recognizing that we need to give women education, but also community. And then obviously companies like myself, HerMD, where we treat patients with menopause and sexual health and do so within an insurance-based system. And then you touched upon sexual health. People are like, well, what is sexual health for women? Well, for men, a lot of people know, well, it's erectile dysfunction usually, but men can also struggle with low libido. For women, it can be sexual pain, vaginal dryness, problems with moisture, problems with arousal, problems with desire, and problems with orgasm. And the nice thing is even though there are technically just a handful of FDA-approved medications, there are other data-driven options, whether it is a CO2 laser or radio frequency device, other medications, over-the-counter curated products. The nice thing is we can come up with a really nice menu of services or offerings to patients, and they can choose what they want to try to treat the symptoms that are most bothersome. And you asked me about what symptoms start first. Usually bleeding changes. You'll start skipping cycles, they'll start to get closer together. You start to go a few months without cycles. And then a lot of women will report the hot flashes, the night sweats, as some of their first symptoms. And I will tell you, Liz, when I had my first 3 hot flashes, I did not recognize that they were hot flashes. And this is like how honest and transparent I want to be, because what they teach you and how they're described versus what actually happens, there is a huge discord.
So describe what happened to you, because that is amazing that you did not recognize one.
And neither did my oncologist husband.
So what happened?
My girls were away at camp because they love it. They go to this girls' empowerment camp. And they were gone in the summer, and you can only write one-way emails, and then they write you letters. So you go days without hearing from them. And so I woke up in the middle of the night feeling like I was having an anxiety attack. My heart was racing. I was having palpitations. And my girlfriends will tell you, I'm a girl that doesn't sweat. I go to hot yoga and I don't sweat. And my husband was like, oh my God, Somi, you're dripping, like my neck down. But the most bothersome thing wasn't that I was hot because I turned on the fan. It was this feeling of impending doom and anxiety and, oh my God, I needed to talk to them. And I was pacing my bedroom and my husband is like, what is happening? And I was like, I think I'm having a panic attack. And so it happened twice more while the girls were gone. And the third time I went, oh my God, because I was like tracking my cycles. And I go, babe, these are hot flashes. And then I had remembered Tamsin's conversation, how she had been under the hot lights and she was on TV. And then she went to the bathroom and put her face on the floor because she was just feeling like, she's like, oh my God, do I need to go to the ER? And that's exactly the way I felt. And Liz, you've got to understand, remember with my mom's history and our cardiovascular family history, I was like, am I having a heart attack? Am I having a panic attack? But that's what I want to do now. I want to prepare women. I said, it is not just a feeling of mildly feeling hot. For some women like me and in non-white women, we know that vasomotor symptoms, i.e. hot flashes, can be a lot more profound and severe. And so likely that is why mine felt like I was dying.
That is so powerful and almost like prepare for the unexpected. So if something's happening that feels off, this is happening to women in an environment, in a health environment where they're not listened to, where their issues are not centered, generally speaking. So what should our listeners know about trying to navigate what is happening to me in a world where they don't feel heard?
track their symptoms. No one knows their body better than themselves. Learn about the menopause symptoms. It can present very differently. Talk to your family about what their experience was like. And then if you want a diagnosis or you're ready for treatment and you've educated yourself, then go into a menopause expert. And there are ways to find those of us that don't have 15-minute appointments, that take insurance. So North American Menopause Society is one of the largest conferences that we attend. But if you plug in your zip code, you can find a provider who has been menopause trained. You cannot have a menopause appointment in 15 minutes. And the other thing is, I get this question, well, how do I convince my doctor to listen to me? You shouldn't have to convince your doctor to listen to you. It should be a partnership. So your time would be better spent trying to find another provider who actually specializes in menopause. It's a travesty. It's really, really hard to be an obstetric expert and take care of babies and stay up all night and then truly dedicate the time that you need. Like, I wasn't practicing menopause care when I was delivering babies. It was too hard. I didn't have the time. I was seeing too many pregnant patients going through and then spending my time delivering and operating. And so find a menopause expert, go in armed with data and knowledge. And I think that way you'll have the best outcome. And don't be afraid to share, hey, I don't want to start hormones. Or, you know what? I would prefer to deal with just my sexual issues first and really prioritize what's bothering you the most, but what you want to address. And I think the other thing that people underestimate is you have to feel comfortable. These are very intimate personal issues and discussions that you're going to have. And if you do not feel comfort with your provider is going to pick up on that too. And you're not going to get as far. And so those are my words of wisdom.
So what actually is there in terms of support, treatment? And I'm thinking everything from mental health support to natural lifestyle changes to various forms of hormonal supplements or just other prescriptions you may be able to provide. What is out there and what's the evidence around what helps ease women through this transition?
Oh God, there is so much out there. So let's just start with the hormone topic. Okay. So hormone therapy now is recommended up until the age of 60, as long as there's no absolute contraindication. And what do I mean by that? If you've had a heart attack or a stroke, or you have BRCA, or you have active breast cancer, you may not be a candidate. You have to talk to your doctor and see what's going on. But there are no equivocal medications for hormones when you talk about treating hot flashes, when you talk about protecting bone and brain and heart. But there are other options. And there are two types of hormones that we need to talk about. Well, three. There's estrogen, right? Lack of it causes the hot flashes, the dryness, the problems with cognition. Lack of testosterone is what leads to all of the sexual side effects. So the low libido, the problems with orgasm.
But I think a lot of women don't realize testosterone is a hormone that women have as well.
It's measurable in our blood. It's just as important for us, but definitely recommended by hormone experts if women are struggling in those areas. There's a test. It's actually called the Female Sexual Function Index. It measures all the domains of sexuality. So all the things that I was talking about earlier, orgasm, libido. So we can diagnose where you're having problems with your sexual function and how we can help you. And then there's the other hormone, progestin, that's recommended for women if you have a uterus, because if we give you estrogen, we're going to make that lining grow and that can increase your risk of uterine cancer. And so we give you progestin to balance that out. So there's estrogen, testosterone, and progestin. And systemic means in your full body, full dose hormone. But then there are also estrogen, and there's a suppository called Interosa, which is DHEA, which breaks down into estrogen and testosterone. And so the suppositories are meant specifically to deal with vaginal dryness, genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which can be bladder dysfunction, frequent vaginal infections, sexual pain, vaginal dryness. So sometimes a woman may not be a candidate for full-blown systemic therapy, but she is for suppositories. But then there are other medications. There are now two FDA-approved medications for hot flashes that are non-hormonal, Brizdel and Veozah. We all saw the Super Bowl commercial by Astellas. That's the company that just came out with that. There are over-the-counter vaginal moisturizers. There are lubricants. And there are also procedures. We are actually presenting our data at North American Menopause Society. There are lasers, but at radio frequency and microneedling, it's all the rage for the face and increases collagen, elastin, blood flow. You can use those same therapies in the vagina to help restore the tissue so that it's elastic again and women won't have sexual pain. It can also help with incontinence. And that same device we're seeing everywhere, M-Sculpt, to tighten and tone the abdomen. There is a handpiece that you can use in the vagina that can help women with incontinence. And so you have these minimally invasive procedures that are groundbreaking. We have amazing evidence. Like I said, we're going to present our data. And so there's a multitude of options for women. And then I mentioned some of the great brands. There was a study last year presented about vibrators and how vibrators not only help with pelvic floor strength, but also can help with those domains of sexuality. And so there's other great brands like Maud and Dame that have lubricants and vibrators that are elegant and designed with the modern patient in mind. And so I'm happy to see that there's so much innovation in this space and so many more options for women. We've come a long way from Happy Hoo-Ha cream. It really did exist, to lubricants and moisturizers that are safe, that are intended for sensitive skin, and that I love and recommend to patients. And I'm glad we're addressing these issues.
I'm glad we're addressing them too. So you mentioned that with women living longer, that now women are potentially spending up to 40% of their lifetimes in menopause. You've also described all of these treatments that can help smooth out some of the effects. You're here also trying to destigmatize the experience of menopause. So I guess I'm trying to understand, do we want to delay menopause? Do we want to ease the symptoms? And what are the benefits of taking this proactive approach?
So, you know, that WHI study that caused us all to throw away our hormones, if you looked at the estrogen only arm, the women that got breast cancer in that arm were 30% less likely to die from their breast cancer. They had a decreased risk of mortality overall by 30%. And so hormones can help prevent osteoporotic fracture, can help us with mental fog, can help us with hot flashes, obviously with our bone health, and with our cardiovascular health as well. And so we have this, what we call menopause window. And so ideally, you want to start hormonal therapy within the first 10 years of menopause. I like the first 3 to 5. The earlier you start, if you are going to proceed with hormone therapy, the better it is, because the less bone loss you're going to have. Think about your arteries as a tube. We all lay down cholesterol and plaque in it. We don't see women start to develop cardiovascular disease at the same rate as men until menopause. So the theory is estrogen lays down a protective lining, preventing that plaque from building. Once we go into menopause, we lose that protection, and so we can start to build that plaque. And so the earlier you intervene and you say, oh, I've lost my natural estrogen, I'm going to replace it, the more likely you are to protect that woman from cardiovascular disease. And same with her vaginal health. I tell patients, we're going to put a pause on this aging and we're going to improve these symptoms. But if you come to me at 75, you're not going to walk out with a 25-year-old vagina, right? That's why the term vaginal rejuvenation is so offensive. And so that is the hormonal hypothesis, or the window, is the data supports the earlier we start when a woman goes into menopause, the better it is for her outcomes as far as cardiovascular protection, bone protection, and just frankly, she's not living with all of those symptoms. She's sleeping better. She doesn't have mental fog. 900,000 women left the workforce in the UK because of menopausal symptoms. Just read the articles in CNN. Menopause is costing us, I think, $1.8 billion because of lost work. Women worry about, what am I going to do if I get too hot? And then the brain fog. I have executives that I've taken care of, and women who work are like, oh my God, if I can't remember my presentation. And then frankly, remember the incontinence piece. If there's not a bathroom close, they worry about these things. And so we have lactation rooms, which is amazing. I love that. But think about it. We don't have menopause rooms where you can go and you can cool down. We don't make sure that there's access to bathrooms. So we have women in the prime of their lives, because that's what menopause is. It's the prime of your life. You've finally gotten there. And they're leaving work or missing work because of menopausal symptoms. And so, as I mentioned before, hormone therapy, if you are a candidate, is now the gold standard. The earlier we start, the better. And there's some people that are not candidates. There's some people that are not going to tolerate it. But the beautiful news is I still hear women in this day and age and they say, well, my doctor said I have to just grin and bear it. And that's not true.
I'm curious too about the sort of emotional side of menopause, what it represents in our society. And I'm 38. I don't think I've had any of these symptoms, although now I'm certainly going to be looking out for them in a new way. But when I think about menopause, for me, a woman who's had a lot of babies, it represents that closing of this chapter. And I could also imagine for other women who maybe have difficult periods or fibroids or parts of their fertility that have been really challenging to them, that it feels like liberation. You work with so many women. Can you help describe what that emotional side is like for your patients?
For a lot of women, they're so happy. They don't have to worry about pregnancy anymore. They're done. They don't need tampons and pads anymore. For a lot of women, yes, it is that loss of I can never have a baby again. But for the majority of it, the hormonal changes have been proven to cause increased risk of anxiety and depression. And so that is why mental health is so important at HER-MD. We treat women with infertility. We treat women postpartum. We treat women for PMS. Any of the mental health changes that can occur due to hormonal changes. And so we definitely see a distinct uptick in anxiety and depression. But what makes me so mad about our healthcare system is that we are so quick to write anxiety medicine or an antidepressant, but don't diagnose patients with menopause. And so they just think, well, maybe I only have anxiety or depression, but no one addresses the menopause. A lot of times, if you address the menopause first, women may not need the additional medications. And so that's why, you know, I saw a question that, you know, why would you bring mental health in the same place? Because we want to address the symptoms of menopause from head to toe. You are doing a patient a disservice if you do not address all of her needs and concerns.
It's also coming to mind that women are often going through menopause, perimenopause, and then menopause, at a time where their own identities are changing. So for example, they may have spent 2 decades raising children and now they're empty nesters and trying to figure out what's next for them and feeling major hormonal and mental changes. So is that another factor of just the stage of life and the way that we think about what women's roles are in society?
It is, but I will tell you the modern patient is changing. I love the Golden Girls, but they're no longer thinking they're going to be like the Golden Girls and crocheting or knitting on the sofa. If you look at menopausal women now, I don't know for sure, but J-Lo is in that range. You know, Michelle Obama, Shakira, Oprah. I mean, you can be a badass in menopause. And I think that women are now seeing it as this awakening or this second stage of their life where they can be productive members of society and not just be looked upon as no longer being fertile. And I think that paradigm and that dynamic is really changing. And that's where I think a lot of the femtech companies, the celebrities coming forward like Naomi Watts, it's making a difference because patients are like, oh, she's amazing. I can't believe she's menopausal. And if you think about it, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, I was asked to do TV and they're like, you can't say menopause on TV and you'll never get a celebrity spokesperson to ever say anything because they're scared about losing jobs, right? They don't want to be identified as the menopausal woman. And all of that narrative is changing. So that excites me the most.
It excites me the most too. I love that. And thank you for setting up this next stage of life, and certainly for many of our listeners, that phase of life as an awakening and almost like a boldness and a freedom. So I love the way that you described that. Dr. Somi Javed, thanks for joining us on the show. Thanks for your work. And thanks for joining us on the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you. It was great talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's it for this week's episode. Thank you so much, Dr. Javed. And thank you for tuning in and listening to this week's podcast. We'll be back next week with another great guest. You don't want to miss it.
As always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. So if you can right now, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Leaving a review takes no more than 30 seconds, but it really helps other people discover our show, and I read all of your feedback. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett, with audio editing from Joel Edinburgh. Our associate producer is Olivia Henriksen. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I'm your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.